Okay, comrades, I'll start my presentation. Yes, I think everybody's here now. This is the title of this discussion will be China and the New Cold War. But it obviously is going to deal with a number of questions concerning China. So I will probably spend as comrade Paul said about 35 to 40 minutes, something like that. I'm not sure exactly. So, in this period of neoliberalism and the deindustrialization of major imperialist powers, such as the United States, or even not so major ones like the UK, China has become known as the workshop of the world. And that's a key part of the context of politics today. And the reason for the rise of right-wing forces such as Trumpism and Brexit with a working class or ex-working class base is this deindustrialization that's been happening in the imperialist countries. So what has happened to industrial jobs that used to provide the material base for strong working class movements in the imperialist countries? And what happened to these jobs is they migrated overseas. To what appeared at first to be congenitally lower income countries, congenital from the point of view of the ruling classes, you know. And China was in some ways possibly the classic case of a country that was in receipt of this migration of effectively of employment from the imperialist world. To understand how this became possible in terms of China in particular, we have to look at the context of the Cold War since World War II, and in particular since the Sino-Soviet split in the 1960s. Well, really, it started in the late 50s, but you know, it became obvious in the 1960s. And in the early 60s, Mao's China was perhaps more demonized than the USSR was because of the revolutionary rhetoric of its leadership. Though that changed later, as we shall see. But China was and is an enormous country with the largest population of any in the world for most of that time, though it's actually been recently overtaken by India. But the context in which the modern Chinese state was created was the Russian Revolution, and then the bureaucratic degeneration of that revolution from the mid-1920s, when the bureaucracy by degrees took power away from the working class in a direct sense. Now, originally, the Chinese Communist Party was a classical Marxist organization. It was led by an inexperienced but genuinely Leninist communist leadership around Chen Hongshu, that based itself on the city working class in great cities like Shanghai, Canton, Hong Kong, and Wuhan, for that matter. But the defeat of the Chinese Revolution of 1925 to 1927 happened in large measure because the Chinese Communist Party was instructed by the Stalin-led Comintern to carry out a long-lived and unprincipled entry into the Kuomintang, which was the party of the national bourgeoisie in China at that time. And those were the instructions of the bloc of Stalin-Bukharin in the leadership of the Communist International. And that bloc was then dominant. And it was a righteous position based on political support for the national bourgeoisie as the agent of revolution, supposedly, revolution that was said to be in two stages. You would have first a democratic revolution led by the national bourgeoisie, and only later would there be a socialist revolution. But the Chinese Communist Party had a mass working class base in those cities, and the national bourgeoisie was far from keen on that. It was very afraid of it and regarded it as more dangerous to its interests than imperialism or feudal warlords or other enemies that it was nominally in conflict with. So the Kuomintang actually conspired against the communists, notwithstanding the Chinese Communist Party's policy of support for the Kuomintang. And it aimed to crush the working class base of the Communist Party, which, of course, the Communist Party had politically disarmed. And Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Kuomintang, launched a coup in Shanghai in April 1927. That actually smashed the communists. The communists were centred more or less in Shanghai. It crushed, you know, it smashed the communists, and it crushed the working class as well. You know, and there was a whole saga when the Chinese Communist Party was disillusioned by the Kuomintang. It turned to the left Kuomintang, led by Wang Qingwei. I think it was based mainly in the city of Wuhan, you know. And then something similar happened to them. You know, there was again purges of the communists and repression on a considerable scale organised by the left wing of the Kuomintang. And that laid the basis for later, at the end of 1927, for a bureaucratic workers' uprising, an adventure in the city of Canton. It was called the Canton Commune, and it really was somewhat artificial. It was not really in tune with the consciousness of the workers. It was, in some ways, it was done as a face-saving gesture, organised from or ordered from abroad, from the leadership of the Communist International. To try and cover for the right-wing policy that they'd actually carried out earlier that had led to the defeat of the revolution. So that was actually a failure as well. It was an adventurist move, and it compounded the defeat of the proletariat in the earlier sort of defeats in places like Shanghai and Wuhan, etc. But after these defeats after the defeats of the revolution in 25 to 27, the party actually left the cities. In some ways, they were forced to, at least temporarily. But they turned that into a program, and they, instead of working as a working class organisation, they sank roots into the peasantry. And over time, you had the emergence of a new kind of party. It's epitomised by Mao's long march into the interior of the country to escape from the Kuomintang's armies. And it consolidated itself around peasant guerrilla warfare. And they did actually take root. And this new party, based on this kind of peasant warfare, it was led by Mao Zedong, and it sort of gave birth to a different way of working, put it that way, of guerrillaism, what became particularly associated with Mao in later years. But that's where it started from the fact that the Communist Party was forced to abandon the cities. And once these armies had formed up, I think Trotsky wrote about this, and he raised the possibility that these peasant armies that had come into existence under the leadership of the Communist Party could actually come into conflict with the working class at some point, you know. And that was actually a crucial issue much later, after the revolution, after 1949. But it took forms that were somewhat difficult for anyone to anticipate at the time. So, I mean, the politics of the Chinese Communist Party were very much in the same mould as that of Stalin's leadership of the Soviet Union, which represented a conservative workers' bureaucracy that had abandoned the goal of world revolution and sought peaceful coexistence with imperialism to stave off the dangers to the workers' state. And as I said, the Chinese Communist Party was based not on the proletariat in the cities, but on China's enormous oppressed peasantry. And it led a huge struggle, initially aimed at national liberation, and also aimed at a bloc with the national bourgeoisie, as before, a two-stage theory of revolution in which socialism would be postponed to a later stage. But that struggle, which took place anyway, was still a mighty struggle of the peasant masses. And the regime that grew up in the Communist Party, even before it took power in some ways, in its armies, resembled Stalin's regime in the USSR. Remember, they actually came to control much of China even before they took proper state. They actually completely took control of the whole country. And on taking power, it was confronted with the reality that the national bourgeoisie preferred the support of imperialism, and that such a multi-class regime that they wanted to form up, they called it the Bloc of Four Classes, including the peasantry, the petty bourgeoisie, the working class, and the national bourgeoisie, that multi-class regime actually proved to be impossible. And that was demonstrated particularly in the counter-revolutionary war that imperialism waged in Korea, neighbouring Korea. And where the imperialists at one point actually threatened China itself, towards the end of the Korean War, when the Chinese Communist Party intervened to stop the imperialists overrunning North Korea, they wanted, that MacArthur and Co. wanted to actually attack China, possibly even with nuclear weapons, but that never happened. The upshot of all this is that Chinese Communist Party's bureaucratic regime, for its own self-preservation, was driven to unleash a fully-fledged social revolution. And it expropriated the capitalists, including the so-called national bourgeoisie. Well, it is a national bourgeoisie. It expropriated it. And it established a deformed worker state with a bureaucratic regime similar in some ways to that of the USSR under Stalin and his successors. So that social revolution made a huge leap of quality in regard to the evolution of production relations. And for 40 years, it struggled to develop the productive forces to go with those social relations. And during that period, it had to drain enormous resources from the peasantry to attempt to industrialize. And it didn't really succeed. And until the 1980s, I mean, China's GDP was lower than Brazil's. And it's only from the 80s onwards that China began to be boosted by these imperialist investments, by outsourcing from the imperialist countries, from the United States, etc. Because China's break with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, made the Chinese Communist Party appear relatively stable for imperialism as an ally. I mean, the days of radical Maoism and the Cultural Revolution were left behind in the mid-70s, and the regime actually openly even under Mao, it had begun to side with US imperialism against the Soviet Union, but it did so more and more as the 70s wore on, and then into the 80s, it became pretty much an ally of US imperialism against the Soviet Union for a whole period, leading up to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But it also benefited from this outsourcing phenomena of imperialists investing in China as in pursuit of cheap labor and investing technology. But this break with the Soviet Union and its alliance with the US made China appear relatively reliable. So imperialism invested huge amounts of capital to transplant the global commodities of production of commodities to China. And that's what created this situation where China became sort of like the workshop of the world. And objectively, you could argue that obviously this Chinese Communist Party was a pro-imperialist. This policy was a pro-imperialist policy, and a treacherous one, particularly in regard to imperialism's war drive to destroy the Soviet Union, which they did actually succeed in doing here. But it had a paradoxical result, in that whereas the Soviet bloc was subjected to the most massive economic shock treatment that caused a massive decline in the USSR, whose driving force was a kind of Western-backed economic war, against the recalcitrant bureaucracy in the USSR, China was more or less left alone in the same period. It was not subjected to the same pressure because it was not seen as an opponent in that period, you know. And the paradox is that imperialist investment and outsourcing provided it with the material and productive resources. It put those resources into a political and economic space in which the basic system of economic planning remained intact. Even though they made these market reforms under Deng Xiaoping, which gave that basic structure, the planned economy, the opportunity to massively, you know, upgrade its productive forces and its material wealth at the time when the industrial capacity of imperialist countries, including Britain actually, but also particularly the United States, were being outsourced and degraded and disposed of. And it really is a paradox, because Deng's market reforms didn't go anywhere near as far as Yeltsin's capitalist restoration did in Russia. They did not dissolve the central state. And that's a decisive difference between them. Russia is not a workers' state today, though I think Putin has gone some way towards trying to reconstruct elements of that central state, but he's only partly succeeded. The fact that he was able to even do this and that he was driven to do so at all is an indication that the workers' state, as a bearer and harbinger of a new and higher mode of production than capitalism, is not quite as easy to eliminate as the bourgeoisie hoped and as the Trotskyist movement actually feared, particularly when Trotsky was analysing this question. Because even when the workers' state ceased to exist, the higher production relations, even if they'd only been there in a merely embryonic form, which is true, you know, were still able to deform the bourgeois successor of the workers' state. And so a new bourgeois state was created in the former Soviet Union as a result of 1991 and then the 1993 conflict over the Russian parliament, events like that, and Yeltsin's tremendous and terrible economic shock. And that actually, you know, the outcome of that was that Putin led the retreat. Retreat from the shock treatment, that is, from the neoliberal offensive. He led a retreat from it, and in some ways a counter-offensive against it, and partially rearmed Russia to resist imperialist subjugation. But that didn't actually recreate a workers' state. All it could do was massively modify the capitalism that came into being, fundamentally deforming it in a mixed economy. We could call it a mixed economy sui generis, a mixed economy of its own kind, came into being. And that being one where the statified element which it derives not merely from bourgeois nationalisation, but from elements of a higher mode of production that interpenetrates with it, modified it in that sense, from the with those relations that existed when it was a workers' state. But because in China the central state was never actually dissolved, we have a symmetrically opposite phenomena. The capitalist elements are severe deformations on the still existing workers' state. And we're not merely talking about the degenerated workers' state as it existed in the USSR under Stalin, because after 1929, forced collectivization in the USSR put an end to the NEP. And people will remember what NEP was, the new economic policy of the Bolsheviks that they introduced after the Civil War. Which legalized to a limited extent capitalist relations in the countryside in order to try and revive the economy after the Civil War, you know, because the economy of Soviet Russia as it was then was in a terrible state, and it needed to be revived, so they allowed a limited revival of capitalism. That was the policy of Lenin and Trotsky, in fact, in the immediate at the end of the Civil War. But however, I mean, as after Lenin died and after the polarization that began within the Bolshevik Party and within the regime in general, about where to go from there. There was a conflict about this, and particularly the Trotskyists in the 1920s were in conflict with Bukharin about this. Bukharin, with Stalin's support for much of this period, allowed the new economic policy to go much further, and the capitalist traders, known as net men, and particularly wealthy peasants, known as the kulaks, were allowed much more latitude by the Stalin-Bukharin bloc, and they became much, much stronger. And the Trotskyists warned of the danger of a revolt by these capitalist elements and advocated a planned industrialization through taxation to reduce the weight of capitalist elements in the economy. And they were denounced as so-called super-industrializers by the Stalin-Bukharin bloc as part of the campaign that eventually defeated them. But then what happened is that when Stalin was, you know, Stalin-Bukharin were congratulating themselves that they defeated the Trotskyists, including on that question of industrialization, then there was a kulak revolt against taxation from the regime. And against the Soviet state, effectively, which endangered the planned economy. So the Stalin faction broke with Bukharin and forcibly collectivized agriculture in response to that. And the Trotskyists gave a degree of critical support to Stalin on this because they viewed the kulak revolt as a immediate threat of counter-revolution, although they were harshly critical of the manner and some of the objectives, in fact, not just the manner, but some of the things that they were trying to do in terms of the forced collectivization, which was not based on any mass mobilization, but simply a bureaucratic repressive process. But you have to remember that the original motive of the new economic policy was for the workers' state to use capitalism in a controlled manner to expand the productive forces. And you have to remember that one of the chief causes, if not the chief cause, of the degeneration of the Russian Revolution was the isolation of that revolution in a situation where they had chronically underdeveloped productive forces. Now, what seems to have happened in China is a result of a different situation. We now actually have a serious development of the productive forces in China. And one very, very startling example of that is DeepSeek, which is more advanced than, arguably, than the United States in terms of its use of information technology and artificial intelligence. It's actually more advanced, more economical to produce than America's top technological giants have been able to produce. You know, the developments of China has kept the central state intact, in contradiction to what happened in the USSR. And imperialist investment, going hand in hand with the deindustrialization of the West, actually gifted the Chinese state the opportunity to develop the productive forces in that way. So you could argue that what's happened in China is an extended version of the new economic policy, which has created a situation where a workers' state with a large capitalist sector, sort of a bit like the NEP men, the NEP men, that sector, that's there to be sure, but it's still a workers' state, has actually managed to develop the productive forces far beyond what was possible in the period of the degeneration of the Soviet Union. And it's even created a situation where parts of imperialism have become to a degree economically dependent on China, which for all its large layer of billionaire NEP men, you could call them, has still got at its core a post-capitalist state apparatus. And it has productive forces that now, in some spheres at least, appear to be as advanced, if not more advanced, than that of US imperialism. So it's on the verge of having greater economic power than US imperialism also. For all its powerful capitalist sector, the driving force that's propelled it to that position is not capitalism per se, but a capitalism supervised by economic planning at a basic level. And that's part of what the idea of NEP was, isn't it? You know, and it's something of a paradox that the decline of capitalism in the early 21st century, and in the late 20th century for that matter, has meant a power where the form of the dictatorship of the proletariat remained intact has actually gained access to advanced productive forces that are comparable with those of the most advanced capitalism, and in such a manner that does actually appear self-sustaining. So you do see these new these unusual phenomena, which are, by the way, they are unusual from the point of view of history as we knew it before the collapse of the Soviet Union, for instance. You see these things like the Belt and Road Initiative. China's Belt and Road Initiative is about building infrastructure for global South countries, and thereby it's increasing its political influence by helping those countries traditionally victimized by imperialism to find additional resources to resist imperialist domination. Now, it's expanding its political influence, but it's not exploiting those nations. It's not behaving as an imperialist power, as a lot of the liberal left in the West will say. You know, the liberal left will say, oh, so China is imperialist, Russia is imperialist. I don't think that's true. You know, I think they actually are expanding their political influence by socially productive and useful use values, actually, for which actually are modifying the relationship between a lot of underdeveloped countries and imperialism and giving them additional resources to resist. And I think that's the cause of the Trumpian hysteria over China. This was not supposed to happen. This is not what was supposed to happen in the when the imperialists were outsourcing their productive resources and their labour contracts, etc., to try and maximise profits when the profit rates in the imperialist countries were falling. They were not expecting to create a competitor, and a competitor a powerful competitor that is not capitalist, you know. And that's somewhat the cause of the Trumpian hysteria over China. You know, they're now trying to combat this with a regime of tariffs and economic nationalism, and yet it looks like that is going to fail. You know, it does not look like it's a stable and viable policy. You know, so you know, I think Trump is going to run aground on this. You know, I think there's already signs that Trump's policy has failed. And he's had to retreat, particularly on things like electronics, from his tariffs, you know. But the thing is that it puts China in somewhat of a strong position. But the Chinese Communist Party has nothing like an internationalist leadership, you know. I mean, its attitude to the foulest imperialist atrocity of our time, which is the Zionist genocide in Gaza, is purely diplomatic opposition. You know, whereas a genuinely communist leadership would have a very different approach, actively seeking to mobilise mass working class movements and on top of that resources to aid the struggle against the genocide. And the Chinese Communist Party's policy is tepid, and it's massively different from that. But logically, you know, the Chinese Communist Party ought to be open to a degree of debate over this. I mean, China has huge productive resources, and it's not a state in fear of imminent collapse as Stalin's USSR was in the 1930s, when it treated criticism from its left as akin to pro-fascist opposition, you know. I mean, the important danger to this workers, to the workers' state still comes from the NEP man billionaire layer, which is, you know, it's considerable. Now, apparently it has reduced lately. The Chinese Communist Party has actually, funny enough, the number of billionaires in China is falling, even as the number of billionaires in the West is massively increasing. And that has to be understood as well. I mean, the state is, there obviously is a somewhat complex relationship between the state, which is the planned core of the economy, and the NEP that's combined to effectively the NEP that's combined to develop China economically and has lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. But of course, if the NEP, there is room for the state to act against the nascent capitalist class if they become too powerful, and there are signs that they have done that somewhat lately, in the last few years. Economic growth in China has not led to a massive growth in inequality as neoliberalism in the West. And in fact, hundreds of millions have been pulled out of poverty, by China's economic development. And it's quite remarkable because China had, as I said, is an enormous country with an enormous peasant population, a generation or two ago. And it's now rapidly become a urbanized, or to a considerable extent, urbanized country with a much higher standard of living. But at the same time, the billionaires do potentially, endanger that, because ultimately, as has been shown in the past, in the West, ultimately profiteering classes do not take kindly to limits on their profiteering and will seek to remove obstacles on that. And as I said, Chinese development has not led to the impoverishment of the masses, but still. The growth of such a billionaire class, even through state-supervised exploitation, is an affront to the aspirations of communism. So you can see a situation. We know that there are minority trends in and around the Chinese Communist Party that look to Mao for their inspiration. We know that. We've heard of these. But Mao was also an isolationist, nationalist figure for all his radical rhetoric at times, particularly earlier, whose influence actually led to the alliance of China with the United States against the USSR. And even though that had paradoxical results, it turned out, that was hardly the plan, was it? It was still an affront to working class unity against imperialism. So if there's anybody on the left in the CCP, in the Chinese Communist Party, present and future, needs to have something better to crystallise around. It needs something that stands in the tradition of the Bolsheviks, of Lenin and Trotsky, and Chen Hutsu, who, although he was inexperienced, his leadership was inexperienced, nevertheless, in its early period, actually embodied the aspirations of Bolshevism and of the working class movement as its central focus programmatically. So China needs a rebirth of working class democracy and a genuine Soviet power. Let's talk about the evolution of our own position on Russia and China, because it's actually been uneven. And we've all, our tendency has come from traditions of Western Trotskyism, which have always been, to a degree, flawed and tending towards centrism. In 2023, we modified our understanding of Russia. We had previously had a position that counter-revolution had made Russia into a highly developed, but basically a semi-colony, And the initial position that we had sort of inherited from trends within Trotskyism that were too, in my view, too much influenced by a strategic affinity to British Labourism, tended to see Russia and China as fundamentally similar, as ex-worker states that had morphed into semi-colonies. And one of the merits of this is, of course, that we still call for the defence of these countries against imperialism. But the defect of it is it couldn't really explain what drove the imperialist hostility to China and Russia that drove the new Cold War of the 20-teens and onwards and up to today, you know, particularly regarding NATO expansion. So in 2023, we modified our understanding of both Russia and China, rejecting the notion that they were mere semi-colonies in favour of the understanding that the power of these states, their ability to stand up to imperialism, derived from deformations on the post-Soviet forms of capitalism that were derived from the weakness of the capitalism that had been restored, given that their productive forces were created under embryonic manifestations of a higher mode of production. And that higher mode of production actually is communism, albeit in its lower stages. Yeah. I think that explained quite a lot. But while it was correct about Russia, and it was a basis for principled and effective defensism, it was still unsatisfactory about China, because they are clearly closely allied. They're not the same, you know. As elaborated again above, the central state in China remained intact, and there was no real neoliberal shock that broke economic planning. It never happened, you know. So we've been discussing and correcting our position for several months now, and this change is the result. And I hope that will provide comrades with some food for thought and things to discuss anyway. So I'll leave it there. Thank you, comrades. Cheers.
Thank you, Jim. As I said earlier, please do indicate when you wish to speak, and please try to keep it to one at a time. So who wants to follow on from Ian's presentation? Anyone? Well, I wasn't quite expecting this.
Okay, I will say something then.
Okay, go ahead, Maui.
Well, thank you for breaking all this up, Ian, and congratulations for these documents. I'm pleased to see that China is a worker state. I'm very, very happy about this. I think that I have read another version, which is more extensive, of many pages in The Consistent Democrats, so I am a little bit off subject, but I'm going to do my best. So, I think that what I have learned or revised from these documents is that, on the whole, with class society, the human relations, the relations of production, retreated from primitive communism at one point, but it is not all that very long ago, historically speaking. And with this step backward, promoted other steps forward in the evolution of the productive forces. I think this is particularly relevant to this subject on China, where what has developed really much is the productive forces, which is obviously giving opportunity for tremendous uplift and positive progression of the relation of production and the human relations. So that lays conditions for a continuation towards on the socialist road, and hopefully, and perhaps depending on how things will pan out, a sudden explosion, it seems to me, in the direction of communism, depending on how the next period develops, because somewhere in the document it shows that China is so huge and its population has been involved in this process. I think it's one 1 billion, more than 1 billion. A population, an enormous population. Is everything okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, yeah. One moment, Murray. Ian, can you move Matt for the time being? You've moved it. Okay. So go ahead, Murray.
So that Chinese population has been so immense that all the experiments which it has made come very close to what you could consider has happened in the world. It's been a world and it's a world, and it's not excluded, it seems to me, that depending on the conditions, there could be another leap, a much bigger leap, you know, beyond socialism on the way to communism. But of course, it depends on how imperialism is going to behave. It depends of the speed of the unification of an anti-imperialist united front, the creation of a world party. All these things are in process. So you know, this is just a way of comparing. So it seems to me that there was a point that Ian made which showed the tremendous importance of the Russian Revolution in all this. China was helped by the great defeat of Nazi Germany, you know, after 45, and that the defeat of Imperial Japan. The war was against of the SSR, by the SSR, was a war of defense against the Allies, and also it was a war in which the Allies were fighting each other. And I think that is something we see again preparing. You can see the conduct of Trump, which represents an attack against its allies in order to discipline them, and then also the need for the worker states or the states which are on the way for self-defense against the attack, these new attacks of imperialism. So it is the USSR that fought Japanese imperialism in Mongolia and in Manchuria. And this helped create, you know, after the war, this helped create the conditions for the victory of the Chinese Revolution. And then there was the Korean War, which Ian referred to, which I call on Comrade to look at again, because that's when China intervened in defense of Korea and also the Soviet Union. So in fact, they were in a united front. The Social Revolution for 40 years struggled to develop the productive forces in China. Then the SSR and China had divisions between themselves, and this gave to the USA an opportunity to detach China. I think the same happened with Yugoslavia, to detach them from the SSR, and then to count that China could become a benign place for American and Western investments. And this, like Ian said, turned China into the workshop of the world. So I think that needs to be looked at again and detailed, because there is something very interesting in that process where the labor force of China, which had come from utter underdevelopment, copied, studied, and it says in the document I read, catapulted another productive force into the workshop of the world, and that was technology. We need to come back on these things. They are super important. A bit of humanity had done this over the centuries, but now this was happening in China in an accelerated way. Imperialism found itself, like we have Trump has discovered, he wants a war on China, but he finds the USA deindustrialized, unprepared, and its allies even less prepared, so that it feels Imperialism feels the need to recreate the Nazi monster to recover the lost hegemony in the market on its part, in technology, in politics, in the development of the productive forces, which now have developed in China in such a way so that Western imperialism is dependent on the Chinese productive forces. This is not just military weakness, this is political and historic weakness of capitalism, the inferiority of capitalism in front of this new creation, which is the worker state. Well, in conclusion, I have taken down a list of the conclusions from the very long document which I read, which I need to reread. So it says China is a worker state on which the capitalist mode of production has become dependent. This is a conclusion, and this must inform our confidence when we put forward programs. Then another conclusion, capitalism is driven by the nose, by the economy. That's my conclusion. That's my conclusion. A command economy is supposed to be the ultimate in despotism, according to the capitalist system. If you have a command economy, you are a despot and you have cancelled all possible human rights. But the human rights they are talking about is the rights of the capitalist to exploit, to make colonies, to enrich a few, and to empower itself of the means of war on the world. This is what they mean by democracy. Another conclusion, but I think that's from the text, it's interesting to note how the growth process in China has taken a leap in quality in recent years. So it's not like there's been a gradual, it has been a revolutionary advance, a revolutionary transformation, even if it's not anti-imperialist, really, as such. It is such a progress that it has revolutionary implication. The conditions for the abolition of class society are increasingly being created. Information technology and telecommunications create the conditions for central planning without any type of bureaucratization. And this is so regardless of whether we're talking about China or any other country. This is a conquest which has been achieved through and via the capitalist system, and that the worker state is capable of turning into the conditions for central planning. The way is being paved for the abolition of the difference between manual and intellectual work. This is super important. Developing capitalist conditions in the world developed universal and unbearable forces for the hegemony of imperialism. China shows this. China lies in the transition between capitalism and socialism. Should the process continue to be empirical, this is the way I read the document, China shows that the productive forces and world exchange have developed favorably for the action of the dominant people if they wish to advance to socialism, possibly more directly to communism. This is my question. In China, with a labor force of 1 billion people, humanity has concentrated in a single country the largest productive force in history. The dollar commodity already becomes dysfunctional, inflationary for global trade. Trump's tariff war against this is a desperate reaction which shows the incapacity and the fear of the capitalist system and the sentiment they have that the BRICS is not something they can deal with, even though it is so limited, in my opinion, because they would like, imperialism would like to de-dollarize the trade of the BRICS. And in the end, this will not depend on the BRICS. It will depend on China and Russia in Vietnam, and how quickly and soon this and North Korea, how soon they start making a cohesion between themselves. Another two or three points. Inequality increases in the world. It decreases in China, which is the proof that something is happening here, which is not following the lines which were traced by the investments and the invasion of capital in China. You see, it goes there and it takes a different turn from what capitalism expected. The hatred for China is grounded, according to me, on the fear that a new economic and social system has arisen, that no sanction, no bombing, and no ultimate weapon exists to overcome. Deformed worker states can become advanced in the transition to socialism. It must lead... So there is a series of proposals in the documents which I think need to be listed. So it must lead, China must lead a coalition of the oppressed with nuclear weapons, stand against extermination, develop the consciousness which it has already acquired in the Communist Party through the Communist Party, with its origins in the Russian Revolution and the Bolsheviks. It needs socialist internationalism. There's a need of an anti-imperialist united front, a world party of socialist revolution, a discussion of peaceful coexistence. And about this, I would like to come back later, about this discussion. And an analysis of the world war, which is being prepared, which is not really explicited in the declarations either of China or of Russia. There is a need to abolish the monopolies. You know, there's still monopolies in they are losing their powers, but there's still monopolies in China. There is a 996, which is the rule by which you have a very long working day and very, very difficult. Then the non-support for the colonial revolution, this has to be changed. There's a need to recreate the commune, to help create a world party, to review the policy of coexistence, and support for the world proletariat. Only 44% of the workers are unionized in China. This needs to be addressed. And so leaning on the workers' interest to help controlling the bosses and the markets, not just regulations and the state. The need for, the anti-imperialist United Front. That's definitely... Now, other people have got to say something.
Who wants to speak?
Diana.
Diana. Of course. Oh, there I am. One thing that... strikes me the difference between the USSR and China with respect to catching up with technology. China and Russia both started in a disadvantaged state, being sort of very, very backward, not very developed. China, I think, had been in the past, but Western imperialism, partly Britain and probably other places as well, had put the boot into China. Russia was technically industrially backward, and it made a massive effort catching up. And my memories in the 50s and 60s, particularly maybe 70s, is Russia sort of did quite a lot of good stuff, advanced stuff with space, for the first first country to get anything into space. But for some reason, they lost their advantage, but China didn't. And I also have some personal memories of China advancing its technical infrastructure and knowledge. And the last job I had was the end of 2000, beginning of 2001. China was what's the word I want? Implementing its telecom infrastructure, and I was one of the team working on that project. But also, we had a lot of people from China itself working on that project with us. Then not long after the end of that, it was Lucent Technologies I was working at. That site closed down. But China's technical has been technically getting more and more advanced ever since then. So I'm wondering why China managed that and then the USSR didn't.
Thank Diana. Sorry, comrade, I didn't realise my mic was switched off. Thanks for your last contribution, Maori. That was very extensive.
Yeah, Ian was extensive.
Yes. Who's next?
I think that the Soviet Union was at a disadvantage because the Americans had decided that they were the main enemy and they invested in China. China had the benefit of them not seeing them as such a threat at that time. And they did that at the expense. Russia didn't have the benefit of getting the West investing in their industries and exploiting cheap labor and all the stuff that China was able to do. The West used China against the Soviet Union. And then, of course, there was all that madness where the Chinese had some kind of a beef with the Russians about, I think they had a border dispute.
Yeah.
I mean, the Chinese did, the Russians did terrible things to China in terms of they had, when we went to China, they told us about how they had all these technical people, architects, engineers, whatever, who were there. I think this was in 56, or 53 when Stalin died, and that the Russians just packed up and left them with nothing. They were, you know, they had all these half-done buildings and whatever, and the Chinese were mad as hell, and they haven't forgiven the Russians for doing that. The Russians do admit that they were wrong. They shouldn't have done that. But anyway, the Chinese had this beef with them, and this was 73, 74. So this went on. They had a border dispute. There were clashes, military, and then they managed to not escalate. But in terms of ideology and support for revolutionary groups like the wars in Southern Africa, the liberation wars, the Chinese then swapped sides and decided to go on the sides that the Americans were on and left the Russians to support, like, Frelimo. And this caused problems in Maoist groups throughout the diaspora, well, almost everywhere, because, you know, there was Chairman Mao saying, you can't be on the same side as your enemy. And here we had them deciding to switch sides during Liberation War. The Russians had allowed the Cubans to come to Africa and to help us to fight off the apartheid soldiers and to win the Battle of Cunavale in Angola. I don't know. It was a very difficult situation then, ideologically, how the Chinese decided to interpret stuff. But the fact that the Americans were able to use them for cheap labor and to expand their the industrial output by moving their factories, etc., to China. Deng Xiaoping, Ping had been to America and had spoken to them and, you know, played nice with them. And so they felt comfortable doing that. So the Russians didn't have the benefit of that kind of input of investment. So that's why the Chinese, now, of course, they see the Chinese as a major threat and all this kind of stuff.
Thanks, Emma. Who's next?
If I can ask Marie a question, if that's okay. Sorry, I haven't put my hand up, Paul, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
The 996 working is really only in the tech and the IT sectors. The average working week in China is supposed to be 40 hours a week. It's the same 5 days a week, you know, 8-hour day that is supposed to be common in Britain and isn't. And they're certainly not in the top 10. But I think that's really down to the outsourcing of, you know, the, shall we say, exploitative, particularly Apple and other companies which want high tech at, you know, the lowest possible working wages. And that has been something which, you know, I think China has stepped back from. Looking up the numbers, I'll be interested to see where your numbers have come from, maybe at another time when we can have a discussion on it. But I'm looking at how exploitative, you know, the West, shall we say, is for what I would call the, I've got three jobs and I still can't earn a living wage. Yes, the Uber drivers, the people who are marginalized workers, who are in far greater numbers in the West, particularly places like the UK, the US, not to mention the US's exploitation of prison labor, which again, just in order to keep, you know, body and soul together, may well involve long hours of very tedious working. But I think the real thing for me is that China has taken, it's now coming up for 900,000, you know, 900 million of its population in out of poverty, and that it is, and it, I was listening to yesterday, I think, to a podcast saying that they now have more middle class wealthy Chinese than the entire population of America, which means at least, you know, over a third of a billion people are going to be in the middle classes. So you were right when you pinpointed that the real difference for Russia and China is the expectation of lower levels of inequality. And far, I think it's also about free education. It is the expectation that everybody will rise to be able to fulfill their aspirations without encouraging debt slavery or the prejudice that comes from not being one of us, which is the bane of the, you know, the public school system, which is obviously private school education, and the nepotism and corruption that is rife in Europe and the UK and the US. Yes, that you have to belong to, you have to have gone to the right schools, the right universities, you have to be connected. It's not about what you know, it's about who you know that gets you into the places of the levers of power. Okay, thank you.
Please, could you reiterate what you wanted to ask Marie? Because
I was questioning the 996 hours that she was concerned about, because I found no evidence that there is any, you know, that the average working week in China is 40 hours a week. They do not appear in the top 10 of people who are working themselves to death. But they have had, but their massive improvement in taking people out of poverty and their free education and their, you know, the other thing is of course, working class wages in Britain and the UK have consistently not improved. I think house prices have risen, I don't know, thousands of percent, whereas wages have only risen about 8 times in the 40 or more years that I've been working. But in China, it's thousands of percentage increase that the workers' wages have increased. Yes, that therefore this is why their inequality has not expanded in the way that it has in the West. And I think that is where the difference in the development is that their socialist ideals have remained far more important to them. You know, that they see their economy as being a driver of equality, you know, of not just equality, but of ensuring that the working classes remain where they should be, which is well paid on a living wage. It was exploitation of capitalism in the 19th century, the century of humiliation, the Cold War, the attacks on, you know, Russia, that were basically about the threat that equality had for Western monopoly capitalism.
Thank you. Before I bring in Diana and then Ian, Marie, do you want to come back on any of that? Because Susan's question was initially asked you.
Yeah, Paul, I think Suzanne has analysed her question, and it's very satisfactory unless Ian wants to say something.
So I'll take Diana first, then Ian, and then Mark C. So Diana, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know whether Susan has partly answered my question, but what I'm in intrigued about is the 996 thing, the long working hours, and that being particularly prevalent in technical industry. I've worked, my job was working in technical development, software development, and I don't know damn well if you work long hours, you can't do a good job. Now, what China seems to be doing is leaping ahead with technical expertise and implementing good sort of technical methodology and, you know, excellent technical development, creating devices, not just things like computers and smartphones, but even electric cars, everything that needs good high-tech development. You cannot get workers to do that if they're working long hours. You just physically can't do it. If you're doing the intellectual bit, the development bit, your brain won't work properly. Your brain, you won't work, you won't think clearly enough. If you're doing the more manual stuff, putting bits together, you will make loads of mistakes. If you're tired, you'll just produce crap produce. So I couldn't work that one out.
Ian?
Just come back on that very briefly. My understanding is that that is probably a Western import, because there is a famous quote from Sergey Brin, who was the co-founder of Google, who said that 60 hours a week is his idea of a sweet spot as to how long the employees should work. Now, this is deranged stuff, but it came from the United States, not from China. And that does actually back up what Susan said about the. I don't know enough about this, I must admit. It probably, there's a lot more work to be done on a lot of this stuff, you know, to actually understand more about China and the precise relationship between outsourced technology, outsourced productive relations, and the Chinese state. But it's pretty obvious there's been a synthesis. But yeah, I mean, I think in the tech industry in the United States, long hours are quite common, as I understand it. That's not true necessarily in Europe, you know, because of the social democracy and people won't stand for it, you know. But it is common in the US. And I think that's probably a US spillover into China. That's my impression, you know, but I'm not sure. Just as regards people speaking, I mean, I think there are a number of comrades here from Korea. I'd be interested to see what they have to say about all this. And, of course, other comrades, this is a new subject. It's not a new subject, but it's a new sort of emphasis and a new position that we're arguing. It may well be unfamiliar, and it's something people will have questions about, etc., and maybe disagreements with, for all I know. You know, I'm interested to hear what people think, so I would encourage comrades to speak. Thank you.
Mark C, go ahead.
Okay, I've probably said it before. Well, I have said it before, and it's probably boring everybody to death now. But but I've been to China on two separate occasions, and my impression of the country was that it's a country with that's very rich in culture and several different kinds of cultures. The population on both occasions seemed quite relaxed and happy to me, and very friendly. I mean, that's just part of that is probably a tourist impression, but it didn't strike me as a sort of country that's struggling. The main thing about it that I saw was that they got protest groups like the Left Behind Women, who are talking about the fact that women are expected to be married at a certain age, and they're actually protesting against that. There's a lot of old traditions that still carry on in China, and they're allowed to happen. You've also got Confucius societies, which goes against the grain of the what the Communist Party is supposed to not like, according to the West. You've got things like, I went to church with somebody, we stayed with a teacher at Shanghai University, and he was a Christian, so we went to church with him on an Easter Sunday. And then we went for a meal afterwards and sat and chatted to everybody. We actually visited the university and spoke to the kids in the class about what it's like to be English and what it's like England's like. So it's it and it, at the time it was a country that was developing very quickly. And you've got there was on my visit to Shanghai, staying in Shanghai. You got TV screens up in the squares where people were sitting watching the politicians speak. You wouldn't have that here. They were actually taking an interest, and some sat down with their tea in the flask and so on. They actually took a big interest. So to sum it all up, it struck me as a country that worked very hard. And I take on board what Sue and Diane say. They're both right. If you work too many hours, you're exhausted. But a country that works very hard but seems to be happy at the same time, and not at all stressed and exhausted like we are over here. To sum it up, it's not at all how the media portray it. I visited the Soviet Union in the early 80s. That seemed to be struggling a little bit. I think that was under a lot of sanctions. But there seemed to be quite a bit of equality. It was a fascinating country, and it's come on in leaps and bounds since then, so they must have done something right. And in comparison to my visits to America, I think that probably China is more impressive on the economic front than the USA is. Fantastic as it is, New York is a fantastic place, but it did strike me on the two visits I made to it on two separate occasions that it was deteriorating very quickly. The first time was during the Trump elections. When he first came into power, all the TV channels had Trump on. They were all praising him, very much more obviously than the BBC do, by the way, which is a little bit more subtle. And then the next time we went back there, there were more people sleeping on the streets. So something was going very badly wrong. Anyway, that's all I got to say, I think. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Can I say something? I think that in the special economic zones, there is real oppression, and the working class is not happy about that, because there were lots of suicides, and people were just people who obviously had come from the countryside into these factories, and the owners actually locked them in. They lived on a compound, and they actually locked them into this place that where they work. And these people were young people, and they were committing suicide at an enormous rate. And the trade union was having difficulty getting the party to do something about it.
Thank you. Who else would like to speak? There's quite a few who haven't spoken yet, so it would be nice to get someone who hadn't yet spoken. Ah, here we are. Hello, Simon.
Sorry, I was just trying to work out how to do this on the phone, so I haven't raised my hand. Yeah, I just want to come back in on this thing about the happiness and the contentment of the Chinese working class, and the fact that a lot of people have been risen out of poverty and so forth. So it's qualitatively different to the experience in the West. But in terms of alienation, before coming to this meeting, I was researching, because I once read about a subcultural group amongst young proletarian Chinese factory workers. I think they're called the Spikies, and what they do is they colorize their hair and they push it into spikes, kind of like the punk star used to do that. And when they're interviewed, when they're asked why have they adopted this, they say, well, we have to resist. It's symbolic of the fact that we're totally discontent and feel totally downtrodden. And we need, you know, this spiky kind of armory to protect us. That's basically what's come out. I haven't fully read the other articles I came across, but there's a lot of alienated kind of manifestations via subcultures. Now, that wouldn't exist, presumably. I mean, this is just an impressionistic point. This is the only point I've got to make. But these things would not exist, surely, if the state of alienation was being eradicated, even though it's slow, etc. And people have already alluded to that in the special economic zones, you know, the suicides. Yeah, I've heard about that as well. So I'm wondering what, you know, how realistic is it really to talk about a contented, unalienated Chinese proletariat?
There's a question for Conway. Does anyone want to answer that? Jonathan, perhaps? Or Ian? I'll take Jonathan anyway, because Jonathan's got his hand up first. And then I take Ian.
Yeah, I'm very wary about commenting about the period of history I'm now living, especially somewhere like China, where I don't really have much contact with. You know, I can talk about Britain a bit more because I live here and I know what's going on. But China is a very far away place, and I haven't got any contacts yet there. And that, so it's very difficult to talk about the period of history you're living in anyway. And I'm sure the situation will look very different in 10, 20 years' time. I was just thinking historically that what now looks like a significant event during the Cold War was when the Chinese supported the Vietnamese against the French, and the Vietnamese and the French were expelled from Vietnam because of China's support for the Viet Cong. And, you know, I wonder how much, that has to do with what's going on now, you know, because I'm not saying it's, huge, but it was a significant event in that the Americans had to come into Vietnam because the French were kicked out by the Viet Cong. And anyway, I'll leave it there.
And John, Ian and then Mark C.
I just want to make one point about alienation, really, is that China is not a socialist society. China is a highly productive workers' state with a large capitalist sector. And the capitalist sector has had a certain influence in industrializing the workers' state, but that doesn't necessarily add up to a harmonious, non-alienated, productive apparatus, not at all. I mean, I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I think it's going to be very uneven, and by definition, a deformed workers' state is not run according to the norms of workers' democracy. We know that. You know, we know China is highly, centralized in terms of its political apparatus, and it doesn't brook, it's modeled on Stalinism. But the material reason, I mean, you can look at, I mean, things do persist despite the material reasons having changed. It doesn't, things, the material, the superstructure doesn't come into automatic correspondence with a material base just because that material base has changed. Superstructures and those things, they have a certain autonomy and they move in different ways. And I think you still need to actually, whether I would call it a political revolution or what you would call it, but you still need a dramatic change in the political superstructure of China to bring it into line with the with what's possible, because of the existence of economic planning, which does exist, and B, the fact that it's now an advanced country. It still has archaic Stalinist methods of governance, and it still has, some of the labour methods are those of the SEZs, which are bloody appalling. They're sweatshops. That's what they were. It was outsourcing. It was a means of circumventing Western trade unionised labour standards and things like this. It's had its paradoxical results. It's led to the industrialisation of China in a big way, and the technical development of China in a big way. But it's, these structures don't just disappear. They have to be done away with consciously by communists and socialists, and they have to be brought into line with those of Soviet power. And as I said, I talked about it in my thing. We need to go back. we need to advocate in the in whatever way we can with the Chinese Communist Party. And we do have there are opportunities to interact with people. You know, even overseas, I've met Chinese diplomats and things at functions where they're talking to the Western left. You know, but there'll be other opportunities. But we need to forge whatever contacts, and we do actually need to promote Bolshevism, i.e., Soviet power, Soviet democracy, workers' democracy, all these things. You know, there are things in China that need to be brought into line with the advanced technology and the advanced production relations that exist. And there are deformations in China, probably several different types of deformations. So, yeah, I mean, these are all things that need to be studied and discussed, you know, in considerable more depth, I think. But nevertheless, we are in a position with this new position to actually properly engage with those people. You know, possibly, you know, I think it puts us in, you know, this position is actually more real than the previous position that we had, which really was, you know, slightly out of kilter in reality. And we are defending China against imperialism, and it's very clear. And it was clear before, but it was on an inadequate theoretical basis, you know, and I think this is a more adequate theoretical basis. That's all I'll say.
Thank you. Mark?
Yeah, I think Ian's right. It's very complicated. The first thing I would say that I don't expect perfection in anything, and especially with a country like China that's taken so much time to develop and allowing capitalism in the system is always going to pose problems. I've read about this suicide thing, but I don't know what the figures are. And I gather the motivation is something to do with the fact that they're not happy with their lot, the working conditions and stuff. I'm not making any excuses here, by the way, but what's worth pointing out is that because China's such a big country, it's difficult to police a lot of stuff that goes on. So you can walk up a road and see somebody dressed in the Mao suit that they were years ago with chickens on the front, and then you go up the road and there's a more advanced factory with people walking in with suits on. The other thing we've got to consider is how many of these young people are influenced by Western ideals. How many of these young people have read about how great it is in America and the UK? In comparison to China, I think it's something that needs sorting out. And I think Ian's right, it's a worker state and socialism needs to be increased. And maybe that will come with time, I don't know. But it'd be interesting just to look into this a bit more and actually get more facts and figures. But it's very difficult to do that because it's a little bit right. Russia, we've been... every time somebody says something about the advancements in China and what's happening in Russia at the moment, they're silenced. They're either mocked or somebody gets morally angry. Somebody puts on this kind of pretends that they're really, really angry so that the public are on their side. The Tories are good at doing that. But anyway, I made myself clear. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Susan. Susan, you're muted.
As Paul has requested, I know it's off topic, but I would like to know, because of the South Korea connection, I very much feel that the UK is an American-occupied country. We have military bases in Britain. We have nuclear warheads, which are being updated. We have massive expansion of nuclear warheads pointed at Russia, with the pretense that they're really pointed at Iran, but we know they're not. South Korea's just very recently foiled an attempt to try and impose a military state upon, you know, a condition of a military takeover, and has foiled it. And I would really like to know to what extent is China now seen as more of a protection against American aggression? And whether you could answer that question from your point of view, because I do believe you must have a very different awareness of what is going on from your own contacts. Please.
Okay, before I bring in Jonathan, I would like to follow on from what Susan said and ask any of our South Korean comrades whether they wish to answer that from their perspective. You can always put it in the chat if you don't feel comfortable speaking, and then perhaps Ian can read it out.
Okay. Can I ask more detailed?
Yeah, go ahead.
Question on Comrade X's question, because what I perceived was that there was a martial law crisis in South Korea, and so are you asking that how does Chinese perceive the recent conflict in South Korea? Is this the question?
I'm really asking whether you feel like America is forcing South Korea to be a weapon against China in the way that the UK is being pushed into being a weapon against Russia. I mean, we've been subjected to massive propaganda about how imperialist, how evil Russia is, how it's only trying to, you know, conquer the rest of Europe, that we are in danger. And if you have contacts with people in Russia and China, you know that that's not true, that this is about US aggression and using countries as weapons. And since you have so recently had this, you know, appalling effort at a military coup in a country which clearly fought it off, you know, it was a fight back by the people to prevent it being, from regime change or not, then I would like to know how you feel about being directed against China, or whether it's something that you just don't think it's ever going to happen.
Okay, now I got the point. First of all, I must say that South Korea is a colony of the U.S. from the very start of this, from the very start of its existence. It was after the fall of Japan, the U.S. military occupied the southern part of peninsula, and they literally massacred the communists during the war. And then the productive force has developed for several decades, and on the surface, South Korea seems like very developed industrial power. But in reality, the proportion of the possession of total capital in South Korea, majority of the industries and financial sector is owned by foreigners, mostly from US and Japan. So it's a colony where imperialists super exploit the super profit and extract the profit out of the country. And also for Korea, our industry heavily relies on the means of production made in Japan and the US. Actually, what makes colony the colony is that those colonies heavily rely on the means of production from the imperialist countries, which have the highest productive forces on the earth. So in this context, the US, we already published our announcement, 5 announcements on the coup on December 3rd last year, that we figured out that the one behind Yoon's coup was the U.S. imperialist, and they tried to, as it was exposed after the fall of coup, the Yoon government tried to provoke the military responses from North Korea, which means that they wanted some kind of skirmishes or some limited scale or full-scale war against North Korea. And we assume that it is the strategy of the U.S. imperialism to better on the foreign worker state of China and the Russia, which is fighting against the U.S. imperialism in Ukraine. Okay. Is this answer satisfying for you, Comrade S?
It sounds good enough for me, but I'll go back to Susan.
Only to ask how many people are... Am I guessing that a large percentage of the population, not the military-linked part of South Korea, but the general population, are they more anti-US now because of being used as what would have been seen as a weapon, yes, on behalf of the US against China?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. For now, there is no widespread anti-U.S. imperialism sentiment here. Still, majority of the working people do not realize that the U.S. was behind this coup. And the serious problem here is the rise of anti-Chinese sentiment, which forms the fascist movement here. And those fascist movement is linked to the CPAC, the conservative, some kind of international in the U.S., which supports Trump and Milei in Argentina, and who was that guy? Netanyahu. So they fuel the Korean fascist anti-Chinese propagandas and funds, and with the support of here local reactionaries mostly from churches, they are now forming fascist movement, and they even raided on the court, which judged Yoon Song-yeol's detention, and they are now gaining more power, and this is quite dangerous situation here.
Thank you. That does explain a lot of why he has not been held to account in the way I would have expected, having you know, what could have been a truly horrific incident if he had killed all of the opposition, if he'd succeeded in killing the opposition and getting, planting a false flag that it was down to North Korea.
Thanks, T, for that explanation. Jonathan, did you want to come back in? I noticed you had your hand up ages ago, but we switched subjects somewhat.
No, it's all right. I'll stay.
All right. I think we're going to have to sort of start winding it up now because it's nearly 6 o'clock, isn't it? So, before we stop the recording, I would just like to ask Ian, before I sum up at the end, what should we discuss in 2 weeks' time when we have another forum? Ian, you're muted.
We can decide that later, but I do suggest we try and finish Trotsky's book on the Revolution Betrayed, which we've been studying for quite a while. We're actually on the last chapter, I think. It's due to be looked at soon.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
But there is also, we also raised the question that we might have a discussion, an educational, on what is centrism. You know, I think that's quite a useful thing to discuss, actually. From the point of view of the Trotskyist movement, I think an education on that would be very beneficial. But that's something for a few weeks' time, I think, you know. But I think this has been a good discussion, at least a preliminary discussion on China. And obviously the questions relating to China will continue to be discussed anyway, because the world is... The whole axis of world development is around these sorts of questions. So we're going to be discussing them again and again. And I see John wants to say something. No, he doesn't. Okay, sorry, I got that wrong. But I think we should... I'll have a look at... We'll talk about it at the branch meeting, but I think we should think about doing Trotsky again. A bit more of, you know, heading towards concluding Trotsky's Revolution Betrayed as a study, which we've been studying for about a year, actually. And on and off. That should be the plan, I think. You know.
Okay, so I'll make a couple of ending... greetings, as it were, before we stop the recording. That's simply to say that thank Conway for coming. We've had 13. So that's quite a good attendance. So thanks for everyone that came and thanks to everyone that contributed. And it was nice to see a couple of new faces. Mm-hmm. And I hope you come next time. And we normally hold these meetings every 2 weeks. All being well, that would take us to May the 18th. Those of you on the mailing list, either by email or on the messenger chat, will get the message as to what the next topic will be. And we hope to see you in 2 weeks' time. Thank you, comrades.
Can I just say, we also advertise these meetings on Facebook as Facebook events. So if people want to follow them or drop us a line asking for a link or something, they're always welcome, yeah?
Yes, okay.
Okay. And I'll close the recording now, yes? Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.